Well, I actually spoke to the governor about El Salvador months ago. We were together in Mexico City for the inauguration of the new president of Mexico, and he had visited a few places that had encampments for the migrant caravans. And that's when I also personally told him my own story about immigrating from El Salvador. So he has always been interested and has been very interested in the issues of the root cause of migration and the role that California can play.
Is it fair to say you pitched the idea to him to make this kind of a trip at some point?
I would say that the governor has been interested overall in El Salvador, and I think that that was already in the making once he found out about my story and talked to his team about it, invited me to come along.
I'm going to get to your story in just a minute. I do want to know, in your opinion, why you think the governor should be there.
I think it's very important that the governor is here in El Salvador. California is home to close to 700,000 Salvadorians. It's home to 50,000 of which are TPS recipients. There is a very direct connection with the state of California to the country of El Salvador. And the more that we've talked to folks on here and organizations and government officials, it's very clear that there is a direct link between the state and the country. And so when you think about the population of California, we're talking about people that have immigrated and built a new life in the state.
That said, should previous governors have gone? For example, should Jerry Brown have made this same kind of trip?
Every governor has different interests and approach policy in different ways. And Governor Newsom wanted to take a very personal, in-depth approach to the root causes of migration. And so he prioritized coming to El Salvador because he really wanted to understand. There are some electeds that choose to look at issues from a balcony point of view and have advisors and people that can tell them about the issue. And Governor Newsom took the approach of actually wanting to get into the weeds of things and actually talk to people and build relationships because El Salvador plays a big role within the state of California.
El Salvador was your childhood home. It must be quite a personal experience to be there in this way. And as I ask you that, would you also set the stage for your own story that began there?
It's really powerful for me personally to come back to my country of birth in this new capacity as a member of the Assembly and as someone that's been invited to come to the country and have conversations about the root causes of migration and the economic issues that are very real to people here in this country. I came to the United States when I was 5 years old and during the Civil War, which was 12 years long. And we immigrated not because we wanted to, but because we needed to in order to survive, in order to live. And that, I think, is a conversation that is often missing when people talk about why people immigrate, why people flee violence and war, and why they choose to do whatever they can to provide a better life for themselves and their families. That's the stage in which I see this trip for myself, as being the only representative of Salvadorian origin in the state legislature in this moment in our nation's history, where we're seeing anti-immigrant sentiment, when we're seeing people from the triangle countries of El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, immigrate because of deep, deep poverty that hasn't been addressed in El Salvador in particular since the war. Being here, being in El Salvador and meeting with the president and meeting with the ambassador and learning about how much the United States is actually investing in El Salvador gives me hope and gives the people of El Salvador hope. And that investment, which is we call foreign aid, is actually a boost to the local economy here in terms of jobs, in terms of prosperity. So if we truly want to think about curbing the regular immigration, we have to look at what the U.S. is currently doing to invest in this country following so much devastation after the war.
Your mom went first to the United States seeking asylum. What year was that?
My mom must have left El Salvador somewhere between 1982 and 1983. I was 2 years old and came to the United States seeking political asylum and was denied. She was seeking refugee status and was denied. but she understood that we didn't really have a lot of choices. So she stayed, and she worked really hard to save money to send for myself and her mother, my grandmother. And it took about 3 years for her to save that. And so early 1986, we immigrated from El Salvador to the United States. And I often think about what my journey would have been if I were doing that today. Because very much like the young children that are leaving and fleeing violence, my family was fleeing war. If I were a five-year-old now, what would my chances be? Would I have been separated from my grandmother at the border? Would I have been put in a cage? Would I be living the rest of my childhood life in a detention set? And I don't have that circumstance now, but I do feel a sense of responsibility in having had opportunity and having a very similar story and now being in this incredible position to be able to talk to my colleagues and to advocate for what is needed and what is just, to make sure that at the end of the day, the policy that we work on both in the state and on the federal level has a human perspective, that we are talking about people and human lives. And I think that is often missing when we discuss policy.
You're listening to my conversation with California Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo. She is a Democrat representing District 51 in Southern California. Assemblymember Carrillo, do people in your district have communication with you about this trip? Are you hearing from them? What's their reaction?
People in the district are incredibly proud that I represent them because I am a Salvadorian American who is very rooted in my own roots and can advocate on a variety of different issues. So whether it's this mission that we're on now, or whether it's the issues that impact our community at home, which are homelessness and housing and education and health care, none of these issues are separate from one another. We have families that are of Salvadorian descent or of Mexican descent and of other ethnicities that are facing all of these issues. As I mentioned, California is home to 50,000 people that received, Salvadorians in particular, that received temporary protective status during the war. And some folks have asked the question, well, why haven't they applied for residency or citizenship? And when I explain that the federal law does not allow a TPS recipient to receive or have a pathway to residency or citizenship, it changes the conversation. So when we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, it includes TPS recipients. We're not just solely speaking about the 11 million undocumented people that live across the United States. We're also talking about TPS. We're talking about permanent residency status, citizenship, asylum, refugees. And so that is what comprehensive immigration reform is. And so I know that my constituents, and even beyond that, for folks across the state of California who are of Salvadorian or Central American heritage, they're proud to have somebody that represents them, that understands their issue, because I have personally lived it. And that, I think, makes me a little bit more sympathetic to the issue and can be a better advocate to what's needed.
What's your sense of how the politics and the atmosphere of today compared to what was happening in the 1980s? And I realize you were a very small child, but you've studied it. You know what was happening in the bigger sense then. How is this time similar or not?
I have Republican colleagues who call themselves Reagan Republicans, and I completely understand what they are referring to. That Reagan Republican era is not the Republican era that we are currently experiencing in the White House. And there is a huge, huge difference. I've seen debates with Reagan. I've seen debates with Bush Sr. where the issue of immigration was spoken about with human dignity. And that's not what we're seeing now. We have a president who talks about human lives and other human beings and calls them animals and calls them rapists, and says things like, they're not sending their best. That is not the dignified rhetoric of any leader, much less that who represents the highest office in our nation. And that type of politics has been incredibly divisive, hateful, racist, And it certainly doesn't speak to the overall values of folks that consider themselves Reagan-era Republicans. And there is no irony lost on me that President Reagan was very much involved in American involvement in the war in El Salvador, and that he is a former governor of California, and that I am now on a trip to El Salvador with a governor from California, trying to figure out how to undo all the wrongs that have been done because of American intervention in El Salvador.
I'm still thinking about your comment a few minutes ago when you said to be invited back to the country now compared to the way you left when you were five, smuggled out, trying to escape. What specifically do you remember about getting across the border as a five-year-old?
I actually have quite vivid memories. I remember specifically that I was wearing one of my favorite shirts, which was, remember, it's the 1980s, so I had a Mickey Mouse shirt with red sleeves and the white center, and I remember my hair was in pigtails, and my grandmother told me that I needed to be very quiet and that I needed to be my utmost best so that I wouldn't get in trouble. And I knew that things, I felt that things were very serious, and I just tried to, at the time, just be a good granddaughter and listen to my grandmother as we traveled. But I didn't really know what was going on. I knew that we had left our home, and I knew that we were going somewhere new. I remember as a little girl growing up, speaking to my mother on the phone and seeing photos of her, but never having actually met her because she left when I was very young. And all I have are photos of us. And so when we were reunited, it felt like a completely new life for me. And that was the beginning of a whole new start, and left everything we knew. And at the time, you know, I'm 5 years old, I don't know what it is that we were leaving. And it wasn't until much later that I fully understood. And then I learned my status about being without legal status, and then had the opportunity, thank God, to have residency and then apply for citizenship in my early 20s. And that has completely changed my life. I was the first one in my family to be able to vote. My four younger sisters were born in Boyle Heights. My mother became a citizen under President Obama, and my father is in the process of becoming a citizen himself. And so that, I think, is the promise of America and what we all try to do to just improve our circumstance and try to live a better life.
Without the violence in El Salvador in the 80s, would your family have left?
If the Civil War had never happened in El Salvador, there's no reason why my family would have immigrated. We were middle class. My grandmother was a nurse. My mother has a bachelor's degree from the University of El Salvador. My father, you know, also a professional. There's no reason why we would have left. Circumstance. The circumstance of war was why we left and why we had to have a new start somewhere else.
I want to fast forward to you winning your assembly seat in a special election in 2017. How many other candidates were in that race?
In the assembly race, there were a total of 11 other men and myself.
So the next question is, how did you win?
Well, part of my strategy in winning was actually the fact that I had just previously run for the special 34th Congressional District race that Congressman at the time, Javier Becerra, had left to become the AG of California. And the assembly member at the time, Jimmy Gomez, became the congressman. He won that race. And I had run for that race, and I think it set me up to run for the assembly seat. And really quickly, two special elections back-to-back, I announced my congressional run after being at Standing Rock, North Dakota, in the fight for water and tribal sovereignty on December 5th, 2016, following the presidential elections. And I won my assembly seat December 5th, 2017, exactly 1 year later.
I have read this week in an article by Elizabeth Aguilera that this trip for you is, quote, an opportunity to set a tone as to what it really means to be a person for human rights, for LGBT rights, for women's rights, and to really set a new pathway for our state and our country's relationships with El Salvador. Those are huge goals. And how and to what extent do you think that even the beginnings of that are possible given the Trump administration and its policies right now?
We had an incredible roundtable this afternoon with Salvadorian leaders and NGO leaders with exactly those themes. The rights of women in El Salvador, or the lack thereof, the lack of LGBT rights, human rights in El Salvador. So when the question is asked, why are people immigrating? Why are people fleeing and leaving violence? You have to look at the root cause. And this is something that is very important to California because we play a huge role in our border to and our proximity to Mexico. So if people are leaving through a caravan and ending up and seeking asylum, then what's our responsibility as a state? That's question one. And then how do we understand the root causes of why people are leaving? So these are it. There are very limited rights. In fact, if you want to look at what repealing Roe versus Wade in the United States looks like, just look to El Salvador. There is a 100% ban on abortion in El Salvador. In fact, El Salvador is one of four nations around the world that incarcerate women for having a miscarriage, which is often seen as aggravated homicide. So can you imagine being a woman who doesn't know that she is pregnant and has a very natural thing happen to her body and is fearful of going to the doctor and has a miscarriage and then is prosecuted as attempted homicide or aggravated homicide. That's real. That happened. There are women currently in prison because of that. And the United Nations has attempted to work with El Salvador to release those women, and some have been released under President Sanchez Cerén, but some is not all. And so when we talk about women's rights, that's what that looks like, especially when it comes to reproductive rights. There are very limited LGBTQ rights. Trans women in El Salvador or trans men in El Salvador have no rights. If you are a trans woman and you, for whatever reason, are arrested and potentially face jail time, there are very limited opportunities as to what your rights are if you are to be incarcerated. And so you can imagine the fear and anxiety that exists within a population of people that are overly persecuted. And so that's the reality of some very minority groups within the country of El Salvador and why they're leaving and why they're fleeing the country.
Assemblymember,
you know, we have to understand that from our perspective in the United States.
Assemblymember Carrillo, I just have a few more quick questions. How do you respond to some of the criticism that Governor Newsom is using this as somewhat of a grandstanding or a more global stage type trip, that he has bigger political goals and this is just part of that plan?
I think that Governor Newsom is doing something that is morally just in taking this trip and understanding it through the perspective of human rights and trying to understand the root causes of migration. So you can either look at it from afar and be criticized because you don't do enough, or you can go and get into the weeds of things and still be criticized because people will see it as a political opportunity. It's none of those things. Like the Governor Newsom has taken the time, the interest, and the desire to want to learn more. And also from the perspective of a father, he's been to the migrant camps. He's seen the children. He's seen the mothers. And so has the first partner. And so they've taken a very real interest in trying to understand what the root causes of migration are. And so I think critics will be critics, but the necessity and need is very real. And the only way that you truly build support or you truly understand an issue is to actually see it and bear witness for yourself and learn from people that are actually doing the work on the ground. And that's what he's doing.
There's been some discussion about the cost of the trip. The final breakdown and tally won't be released for a while, we understand. But do you have any issues with some of the expenses being paid for by the California State Protocol Foundation? I guess the involvement of nonprofits in some of the costs for this trip?
The state doesn't have any type of discretionary funds for this type of trip. So unless you're an incredibly wealthy person outside of the governor or anyone else, how are you supposed to take these trips? We don't want to use state or taxpayer dollars for it. That would be, there would be more critique over that. So these are ways in which you can actually fund these trips and learn about things that impact the state without it having to be at the cost of the taxpayer. And I think that's a good thing.
My final question, I guess, is about perspective. With the experiences you've had, the life you've led, and the opportunity that you have in this place of power now, what to you is the true power of your story?
I think the power of my story is that it is the story of millions of people across America and certainly within the state of California. And if people can see themselves in me and people can see that they can achieve success and they can be involved politically and they can make a difference, that's wonderful. If the people of El Salvador can look to me and say, we can achieve that as well, or we have representation that knows our story and that knows our interests because she's lived them, that's powerful. And it is also a lot of responsibility to bear. And so I take my job very seriously, and I take the opportunities that I have very seriously to be able to work with the governor, to work with my Assembly and Senate colleagues, to work with our nonprofit groups, to truly advocate for the best for people. Because regardless of what it is that we do in this capacity, when we think of policy, when we think of advocacy, when we think of any type of change that we can make, at the end of the day, we're talking about people's lives. And the everyday person isn't thinking about the political maneuvering of an elected official. They're thinking about, how am I going to pay my rent? How am I going to pay my mortgage? How am I going to put food on the table? How am I going to make sure that I have gas in the car to get to work? And it is our responsibility and duty as the elected officials to make sure that people live their best lives and that they are able to live it in dignity.
Do you believe then that a multitude of these personal stories, as you say, getting into the roots and underneath the headline of what's happening, can be strong enough to change the trajectory of some of the rhetoric that is going in the other direction right now?
I think a lot of the responsibility is also on the media in telling those stories. And having a background in journalism, I look at the way that sometimes these stories are told, and I often find it that they aren't as compelling as they can be. Because instead of focusing on the issue that impacts people, sometimes the media can focus on the political maneuvering of someone and why someone is doing something for their own benefit in trying to strategize a larger point of view, versus looking at it from the perspective of what are the lives that are going to be impacted. We had incredible conversations today with people that have tried to immigrate to the U.S. We've had conversations with women who have been victims of domestic violence. We had conversations with a young man who just turned 18 and who made the journey when he was 15 because he wanted to help his parents, his mother in particular. And when I saw into his eyes, what I saw was a young boy who was forced to grow up really quickly. We went to a art center today where there were 11 and 12-year-olds who were learning to play music. And a local city councilwoman told me that most of those young boys had been rescued from gangs. And the question was, can art and education play a role locally in El Salvador to ensure that these young people have hope for their lives? And so I think those stories, as well as my own, play a huge role in trying to determine what it is that we can do, both federally in terms of the foreign aid that is a necessity in El Salvador and all the groups that receive that aid, that help the people find some kind of economic prosperity within the country so that they don't have to leave, as well as the role that the state plays and that the governor plays to ensure that California continues to be a good partner to a country in which California is home to close to 700,000 people, more so than any other state across the United States.
Is there anything then that I haven't talked to you about that you want to say at this point in time about where you are in El Salvador and what's happening around you? I don't want to let this moment go without giving you the opportunity to express what you truly want to express.
I would say that there are two El Salvadors. There is the El Salvador that we often hear about in the news, one that is riddled with violence and poverty. And then there's the other El Salvador that has hope and is working incredibly hard for economic prosperity locally, to improve education, to improve healthcare, to improve on the issues of human rights. And that's the El Salvador of the future. That's why this foreign aid or really an investment the United States can do within the country of El Salvador is huge. Even if we were to look at it, something along the lines of the Department of Homeland Security investing in the country, the Department of Homeland Security, I should say, spends about $27,000 to detain and repatriate one person back to El Salvador. Those $27,000 can help 33 young people earn employment and get job skills within the NGOs that are currently already working in El Salvador. And so it's perspective. It's about, this. If we want to curb irregular immigration to the United States, then the foreign aid that is currently being invested in El Salvador helps with that. So cutting those funds will be detrimental to the future of El Salvador, and it's not going to improve the people staying within the country versus immigrating to the United States. And so we have to look at what we're doing as an investment to a nation that needs help, that has huge connections, not only to California, but across the United States, and try to do the best we can so that there's economic stability and economic prosperity within the nation.
Assemblymember Carrillo, thank you so much for your time from El Salvador. I have appreciated talking with you. I'm glad you had so much time to spend with us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.